News and features from around Australia and around the world. This is Travel Radio Australia. Here's your host and travel guide, Renz Veers.
And welcome to the program. Destinations on today's show: Normandy, France; Christmas Island; London, UK; the Netherlands. And we'll find out about cruising on the Emerald Princess, and particularly the entertainment offered on board. So that's all coming up. First up on the show is our good mate Jeff Harrison, all the way in Normandy, France.
My guest this week is Fran Lambert, who is the press officer for the Normandy area in France, a beautiful area. And Fran, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much for having me.
Now, Fran, tell us about Normandy for people who haven't been there before. It's a fantastic area of France.
So Normandy is situated on the northern coast of France, northwest, in between the Picardy region and the Brittany region. It's very easy to get over to from the UK, which is one of the primary reasons why it's so popular with the UK market. We have four ports. We've got Dieppe, Le Havre, Ouistreham and Cherbourg, all of which are connectable to the ports of Portsmouth, Newhaven and Poole. It's just a really lovely area to go to, whether you want a week away with the family or just a short city break or just a weekend break to discover some history, whether it be medieval or anything to do with the Second World War and the Battle of Normandy and the all-important D-Day.
Yes, and tell us about some of your favourite things to do over the, in this area of Normandy.
It's very, very diverse as a region. You've really got five very distinct areas which have their own particular personalities. You've got the Manche area, which is the most western part of Normandy, which is very wild, very, very long coastline, and it's absolutely beautiful because it's great for cycling and hiking. Particular areas are the Hague Cape, which is absolutely beautiful. Beautiful, very, very good for walking. We've also got down in the south, you've got the Orne region, which is home to the Normandie Maine Natural Regional Park and the Perche Natural Regional Park, which are both very popular with Parisians because they're very easy to get to, whether on the train or by car. They're not entirely reminiscent of the countryside in the UK as well, which is why they're so popular with expats. You've also got the Calvados-Artemont, which is kind of like a county, I suppose, in the UK. Calvados is particularly famous for all of the medieval centres such as Caen, which is where William the Conqueror lived, Falaise, where he was born. My favourite parts would probably have to be the D-Day landing beaches. I mean, they're a very, very important part of Normandy and well worth a visit. You've also got the area up in the northeastern part of Normandy. They've got some fantastic areas like Le Havre, which is a very trendy port, more for the younger listeners. And it's probably where all the younger Parisians go on holiday as opposed to the national parks because it's by the sea, lots of bars. It's its 500th anniversary next year, so there's going to be lots of things going on in the summer as well, from May to November. So that's thoroughly worth a visit. And not to be forgotten, you've also got Giverny, which is down in the nearest département to Paris, which is where Monet lived. All of the areas around Giverny are well worth a visit. It's very green, very lush, lots of amazing gardens. So it's very difficult to pinpoint my favourite place, but I think there's something for everyone in Normandy.
And tell us one or two of your secret destinations that are off the beaten track or whatever that can really highly recommend to people. What about the food? The food must be fantastic.
The food is fantastic, and it really depends on what time of year you choose to go to Normandy as to which part of Normandy is best for food. All year round you've got fantastic seafood because you've got such a long coastline. You've also got down in the kind of middle of the region, places like Camembert, the famous cheese. And you've also got Livarot, which is kind of like a stronger version of Camembert. And you've got a lovely, very soft, mild cheese called Neufchâtel, which you can get from near to Dieppe. And it doesn't get as much of a mention as the other cheeses, but it actually comes in the shape of a heart, which harks back to wartime when the local ladies used to make blocks of cheese to give to the local soldiers who were posted there during the war, and they made it in the shape of a heart to show their affection. So it's quite a nice story as well. You've also got lots and lots of different types of fruit trails, which are more up in the northeast of the region, which are really good to go to in spring and summer. And you've got the all-important cider trail, which goes through Calvados and into part of the Orne. So for anyone who likes apples, that's a must.
And having a little cheeky drink or a cheeky champagne along the way, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, champagne, I have to say, doesn't come from Normandy, so it's not an indigenous drink, but it can be found in abundance. The main tipple for the region is Calvados, which is like an apple brandy, and the older the better, preferably distilled in an oak barrel to give it that lovely golden colour. You've also got Pomme, which is a combination of Normandy cider and Calvados, and it's really nice, very sweet, and it's also often used for either an aperitif or a digestif to help your food go down after a nice meal. And you've also got the apple cider and pear cider. The area of Domfront, which is down towards the south of the region in the Normandy Maine kind of area, is very famous for pear cider, which is called Paré, which translates to Perry in English, and that's fantastic and well worth a try as well.
That's great. Well, how can people find out more, Fran Lambert, the press officer for Normandy, online?
The best thing to do would be to go to www.normandy-tourism.org. There you'll be able to find all the information on the best places to visit, the best hotels to visit, the best restaurants to eat at, and most importantly, all the food festivals going on throughout the year and the historic places that you can, whether you're more after stepping in the footsteps of William the Conqueror or exploring what happened in Normandy during the Second World War. There's really a bit of everything for you there.
Fran Lambert, the press officer for Normandy, thank you very much for being on the program this week.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jeff Harrison, normally based in Australia, but currently spending a few months or so in Europe, and particularly Amsterdam. But he was reporting on Normandy and France. There will have another segment from Jeff later in the program where he will be reporting from Amsterdam. Next on the show, a track from our friends at Travel Writers Radio in Melbourne, and host Graham Kemlow chats with Linda Cash, who is very familiar with the tourism aspects of Christmas Island.
Well, it's great to have Christmas Island on the line. Actually, not in Christmas Island, but I'm talking to Linda Cash, who runs marketing for the tourism people on Christmas Island.
Thank you so much, Graham.
If you were on Christmas Island, you'd be quite a few thousand miles away, wouldn't you?
Oh, that's exactly right. I did actually live on Christmas Island for 10 years, so I do know the product intimately. And, well, yeah, we're only 360 kilometres south of Jakarta, so and 2,600 kilometres from the midpoint of the Australian mainland. So, yeah, pretty far away.
Now, obviously, famously, you were a place where some refugees sought asylum, and there was a bit of a tragic end in one situation there, but that's all over now. You don't have refugees or boat people coming to Christmas Island anymore?
No, there hasn't been a boat arrival on Christmas Island since 2013. We do have Border Force actually sit off our northern borders to patrol the waters and turn back any boats that do come into Australian waters.
Okay.
So, yeah, we haven't actually seen a boat arrival for quite a long time. It is certainly part of Christmas Island's history, though.
Yeah. Well, people might be wondering, why the heck are you talking to Christmas Island? Well, it's Christmas. That's one reason, isn't it? And I guess,
oh, look,
have you got Santa living over there?
Oh, look, this is where he spends his summer holidays.
is that right?
It's a beautiful tropical island. You know, we're only 10 degrees south of the equator, so it is a tropical island. And, you know, most people don't know about its natural beauty and about the nature that it absolutely abounds on Christmas Island. And I don't know if you've heard, but we've actually just been named one of Australia's top 10 beaches
Now, that's the real reason I'm ringing you. I just thought I'll lead people on for a minute because we'll have a bit of fun. It's that time of year. Yeah, you have. You've been named in the top 10. And interestingly, we just got a media release into the office, I think yesterday. Cocos and Keeling have grabbed the top spot with a beach there. That's not that far away from you, is it?
No, and that's the fantastic thing. Cocos Keeling Islands are 960 kilometres southwest of Christmas, and you can actually visit both destinations on the same aircraft. It's Virgin Australia that flies out of Perth and does a triangular route that services both destinations. So now you can actually visit Christmas and Cocos, so two of Australia's top 10 beach destinations, on the one holiday ticket.
Is it yours that's called Cozzy's Beach?
No, that's the Cocos Keeling Islands. Ours is... Ours is Dolly Beach, named after, Dolly Beach. All of the beaches on Christmas Island, of which we have 11, are all named after early administrators or managers of the island. So so we've got beaches like Dolly and Ethel and Muriel. So, you know, they're all sort of older names.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Yeah, it is. It's lovely. But we're certainly not, you know, we're not just a beach destination. In fact, I would go as far to say that the beaches are secondary to the other tourism experiences that you can get on Christmas Island.
So why was your beach named the best? Has it got beautiful sand or crystal clear water or coral or
All of the above, but also it's the experience. It's the total experience of getting to Dolly Beach. You're about 20 kilometres out of town, out of what we call town, which is settlement.
Yeah.
And you go down a four-wheel drive track for about a half an hour, and then you have to walk through the jungle for about another hour to actually get to this beach. So what you're doing, but in the meantime, you're getting this most incredible nature experience. You're walking through rainforest where you've got, you know, 13 endemic birds. You've got 40 million red crabs that David Attenborough rated as one of his 10 most amazing wildlife migrations. And then when you get to the beach, basically the only thing you're going to find there is the tracks of nesting turtles, you know, and you're sharing the beach with robber crabs and nipper crabs and blue crabs and red crabs. And, of course, it's Dolly Beach has also got what we consider one of the world's best natural spas, because you've got these beautiful rock pools, crystal clear water, 28 degree water temperature, and you just get massaged by the ocean.
Oh, that's that absolutely sounds fantastic. Now, all those crabs, are there any you can eat?
No, all of our crabs on Christmas Island are protected.
Are they?
So 63% of the island is national park.
Yeah.
So all of the crabs within the national park are protected. But the red crabs, which is obviously the ones that are most prevalent, with 40 million of them, they're a land crab, so they don't actually have any meat in them. They're just sinew. So I'm absolutely sure that if you could eat them, we probably wouldn't have 40 million of them.
No. And now I also heard a story that there is an experiment going on the island with the introduction of, is it a bee that's trying to protect the red crabs?
It's a micro wasp.
Wasp, right, okay.
A wasp, yes, but it's a micro wasp. So when we say micro wasp,
it gives you a micro sting, does it?
No, it doesn't sting at all. It doesn't actually have a sting. And
okay.
Its size, if you look at the 20 cent piece and look at the zero on the 20, that's the size of the wasp that we're actually talking about. Oh. So we're not talking about a stinging wasp at all.
Oh, I haven't got one of those in my pocket. I haven't even got a $20 note in my pocket. So I can't compare, but it's pretty small, yeah?
It's tiny, yeah. And what Parks Australia are actually doing is introducing this micro wasp as a to control the yellow crazy ant on Christmas Island. So it's a biological control to try and eradicate the crazy ant. Now, the crazy ant's been on Christmas Island since the early 20s, the early 1920s, and it was only in the sort of late 1990s and early 2000s when we, you know, effects of climate change, some very dry, wet seasons, the crazy ant actually developed super colonies. And what they do is they spray formic acid in the crab's eyes, and the crab's are blinded and they can't feed, so they die.
Oh.
So this wasp has existed in Borneo for a very long time, as well as where the crazy ants are. And what it does is it lays its eggs in the food source of the crazy ant, so the crazy ant is not able to form super colonies. So it doesn't specifically do anything to the ant, it just disrupts its food source. And, of course, if they don't form super colonies, they can't damage the crabs.
I've got two words for you, Linda. Cane toad.
Don't say cane toad. We have heard that so many times you would not believe.
Well, no, is it going to be a problem?
No, absolutely not at all. Parks have done extensive biological testing.
Right.
Quarantine have been on the island. When I say extensive testing, this testing has been going on for over 10 years.
Right.
And there is no way that they would release anything that would harm the other wildlife on the island. So, yes, we've certainly learned our lesson from the cane toads, I can tell you that.
Oh, well, that's good. Now, Linda, it all sounds like a wonderful wildlife experience. Can you do you have to sleep rough, or do you actually have accommodation that would bring Australian visitors over for a different experience?
Absolutely. We've got several various standards of accommodation. Now, the thing about Christmas Island is that it's very small as far as tourism numbers. So we only get about 1,500 visitors a year. So not only are you getting that really unique wildlife experiences, you're not having to share it with the masses.
It's exclusive.
So It is absolutely exclusive.
Right.
So, for example, one of our most popular tourism hotels right on the ocean front at Settlement there only has 12 rooms.
Okay.
So it's basically looking straight out over the Indian Ocean. It's got a lovely little pool. It would be 3 to 4 star Australian standard. So you're sitting on your deck drinking your duty-free gin and tonic, watching, you know, the dolphins in the ocean, the endemic birds flying past your balcony. It really is a 5-star nature-based experience.
Okay.
We don't have the 5-star product, so you're not going to find the Hiltons or the Sheratons or anything on the ground. All of them are family-owned properties. But, we certainly do have some accommodation for tourists that are looking for that unique nature-based experience.
And I guess the obvious question is, it's obviously very remote. It costs you money to get food and fuel and all that over there. Is it an expensive destination for a visitor?
It's probably, because we don't pay GST, we're an Australian territory as opposed to a state, and GST is administered by the state. So
right.
We don't pay GST, but then we do have to pay freight. So it's probably a little bit more expensive than the Australian mainland, but then once you're there, you don't have any other expenses. So once your accommodation and your food is paid for, we don't pay for parking. You know, we don't have any of those sort of daily expenses that you have in other sort of tourism destinations. So whilst it's probably a little bit more expensive to get there, once you're there, there's not, you know, we don't have major shopping centres, so you don't have to worry about any of that, so you can't really spend a lot of money when you're there.
Okay.
Are the flights
expensive?
You can, from just under $1,000 return from Perth, flying Virgin Australia.
Right.
Obviously, the best value is if you can use your Virgin Velocity points and not actually have to pay for the flight.
Yeah.
Virgin flies twice a week, but also on Christmas Island, we have access direct from Asia. So we have a Jakarta flight that comes into the island every Saturday. So from the east coast of Australia, quite often it's cheaper to go up to Asia and then down through Jakarta.
That's an interesting concept.
Yes, well, the majority of our visitors, given the challenges that we've had with our branding over the last 10 years or so in the Australian media, a lot of our visitors come from Europe, from Asia, come for the diving. We have a German dive operator on the island. We get a lot of British bird watchers come through because of the number of endemic species. So a lot of our visitation is actually international, which is really unfortunate that Australians don't know what a gem we actually have out there.
Okay, and is it full for the December-January period?
December-January is generally a fairly busy period because it's when the red crab migration happens.
Right.
You generally do need to book in advance.
Right.
So I guess if you're going to a destination like Christmas Island, you're probably looking at a, you know, 3 to 6 month lead time for your bookings anyway.
Okay.
So, if you've got that lead time, you'll certainly find flights and accommodation. And obviously with flights, the longer lead time you've got, the opportunity for cheaper flights.
Okay. And Linda, if people want to check the place out, there's obviously a website. What's that?
Yes, christmas.net.au.
Graham Kemlow from Travel Writers Radio chatting with Linda Cash about Christmas Island. Next on the show, a grab from our sister show in the US, in California actually. Arthur von Wiesenberger and his offsiders in the studio in Santa Barbara chat with a regular contributor, Richard Torren, who has just returned from a trip to London in the UK.
This is Travel Radio Australia.
You know, when you travel, one of the guys, actually he's been one of our great correspondents from around the world, specialist in Asia, actually.
Right.
I've learned more about Asia, thanks to Richard Torren, than any book I could pick up.
Yeah.
And actually went to Asia with him, and that really was an eye-opener, going to Japan and experiencing that. But he doesn't just make Asia his little globe traveling area. He goes all over the world, and he just came back from England, I think, just a few days ago. So joining us in studio is the one and only Richard Torren of Clarets. Hello, Richard. You do travel all over, and is it true, do you find that when you go to Asia, are Asians more attracted to the fact that you're a Westerner?
I'll take anything I can get at this age, so I'm not quite sure now.
I think he's going to take the fifth. That's what I think he's going to take, as opposed to drinking the fifth. By the way, speaking of drinking, you are, famous for Clarets and
yes.
the Port Authority, Clarets being one of the fine premium wine negotiants in the world.
Yes.
Petrus is like, you've got it running through your veins.
It's like
you?
Perrier.
Yes. Petrus is your Perrier.
Yes.
But you're also an author. You're working on a book, right?
Yes, I am.
What is the book?
It's a novel. It's about wine and terrorism.
Wine and terrorism?
Yes.
What, someone drank your wine? And you're going to hit them over the head with a bottle?
More to follow. To follow, I hope.
Do we have a title yet for the book?
It's called Death in a Good Year.
Oh, I like that title.
That sounds pretty compelling.
Yeah. Well, I hope we'll have you on in the near future talking about
it. Would be nice
that.
To be on as an author as opposed to a wine merchant.
Well, you're on as a globetrotter, too.
That's absolutely.
Right. All right, so you were in England recently, right?
I was in London last weekend.
Yeah. Now, London, of course, is always expensive, but I gather it is a little bit better deal right now.
Well, the pound is very weak, therefore it's a tourist bargain. It's the second time I've been there since Brexit, and there's no... London's a big construction site. There's prosperity, there's building, the restaurants are full. It's... People say, because in England, you never think about how good things are going to be. People say... It's a downward spiral, but nothing bad has happened yet, and things seem to be pretty good.
Now, one of the things I've noticed when I go to London, there's one thing lacking.
English people.
Yeah, it's like they've all left, and now you've got foreigners living there, Chinese, Asians, Middle Easterns, but where are the English?
I went back to the apartment block where I was brought up in the center of town, and I was told that the ownership was 85% Middle East.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, of course, you know, I can understand when it's hot down there in the sandbox, everybody wants to come to England because it's cool in the summer. Relatively speaking. But what happens when it's rainy and cold?
They seem to love it. But what you've got a multi-ethnic cosmopolitan community, and it really is fun. I mean, the biggest improvement to the restaurants, eating out, going places, is just super.
Any favorite restaurants in your book?
I still like traditional ones like Scalini, but I was there at the Woolsey this
time.
Oh,
yes. That's the one that was an old car store. Right. Originally down next to Fortnum's, right?
But you're spoilt for choice. You just every
so many.
Single, so many. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
What's that place, Cheltenham Firehouse? Did you get to go there?
Yes, I haven't been there, but I've heard great things.
Great fun.
Yeah.
And it turns into a nightclub later, which is, I think, always a good thing with dinner. Then you can dance off the calories. Now, okay, so you're in London. You're going to come back to the U.S., and you're thinking about getting a one-way ticket.
Yes.
That can be a big range of options, right?
I couldn't believe it. I had come from Asia, and I had been going home directly and changed my plans. I didn't have a ticket home. And you know, one-way tickets have been the cash cow of major airlines for a long time. Mm-hmm. And when I looked online, it was horrific. Virgin,
really?
Upper class, one-way, £7,000.
Wow.
United, listen to this, United in economy, one-way, £3,000.
But can't you buy a
you buy round trip for £4,000? But airlines, instead of seeing the opportunity for one way travel, use it as whipping boys to get big revenue in. Mm. So I decided to go elsewhere.
Okay, and where'd you go? I
went to the concierge, and I started to look and think of one way deals, and Virgin was really expensive. Virgin was £2,000 in economy. Mm-hmm. And in the back of my mind, I'd heard about an airline called Norwegian Air. So we rang up, and hey presto. So I got a little list. So the economy, United 3,000 one way, British Airways 3,000, Virgin 2,500. Norwegian Air one way from $299.
Give me a break.
Now, that's not going to be necessarily on the day, but to cut a long story short, they've got it's not quite business class, but it's pretty damn good. £795.
One way.
Walk on, London, LA.
And how long in advance did you buy the ticket?
Oh, a long time, 3 hours.
Oh, we'll see.
So you could buy 11th hour, you were able to get a seat.
Yes, and it's in their premier cabin. You go from Gatwick, and I must tell you, as a traveler's tip, going from Gatwick now, Gatwick is a revelation. It was the worst of bad airports. Mm-hmm. They've cleaned it up. The admin and getting through immigration passport, it's a song. It is so quick, and it's marvelous.
Better than Heathrow, then?
Much better.
And Gatwick is how far from London?
You go to Victoria Station. You take the Gatwick Express, which runs every 15 minutes. It takes 26 minutes to get down there.
Oh, that's really easy.
Yeah. It is.
It's really easy.
It's a much smaller airport.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you go, if you flew into Gatwick and then you were going to fly it elsewhere, are there other airlines flying out of there?
Or there are.
Yeah,
there
like
are. But Gatwick Heathrow is a legendarily bad transit. If you're going in to Gatwick, you want to go out of Gatwick. Otherwise, it's a real pain.
Yeah, true.
Anyway, yeah. got to the airport, easy check-in. And the planes are brand new 787s. They're spotless.
Wow.
Really nice.
So the 787 is the Dreamliner, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've never been on one. What's it like?
It's got two wings, two airlines. I mean, it's a very nice plane. Is it
like the 767 or is it better? Or the 757,
No, it's like more like a 767 because it's got twin aisles. It's got two aisles. Ah. I mean, the economy cabin is like most economy cabins, except it's brand new and they've got individual screens in the seats.
Right.
Very nice. And the premier cabin, not quite beds, but nicely reclining seats, footrests, good video. It was terrific.
How was the food?
It wasn't. I mean, it was awful. Uh-huh. But you wouldn't even look at it for the food. Yeah. At that sort of value level, to go across the Atlantic comfortably for that amount of money is just terrific. And it makes a mockery out of the other major airlines.
Yeah. Wow.
Interesting.
And it was full.
It was
packed.
It was packed.
How's the crew?
Very nice. I mean, young, very well, nicely dressed, nicely presented, nice service. Everything was absolutely spotless. And having brand new planes, of course, is very nice.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's nothing like it. Now, you're a beverage guy. Any beverages on board?
Yes, they serve.
You have proper wine?
Yeah, proper wines in a bottle with corks.
Of course.
Yes, with corks.
Wow, not too bad.
It was nicely served. It was all super.
Yeah, and you arrived, your bag made it off in what
bags came straight off. It's number 4 terminal, LAX, the same as the other international airlines, and altogether a super bargain. If you don't want to pay for United and Delta and American, it's a super alternative, and for a traveler, really great value for money, one way or both ways.
Wow, that's a really good tip, yeah, because, for some reason, I think Norwegian Airlines, I'm going to get on a plane, I'll end up in Oslo. Who knew you could fly from LA to London?
Yes. And they've got, if you look on their website, lots of cities in America. I think they go to San Francisco as well. It's just a super alternative for a budget-minded traveler not wanting to deal with all the major airlines. It's not like going on the major airlines is such a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
The American airlines aren't exactly stellar. So this is a great alternative and great value.
Best hotel in London? Where'd you stay?
Dorchester.
Wow. On Park Lane, huh?
Yes.
Wonderful hotel.
Wonderful.
Beautifully run.
Beautifully
run. Earlier Mr. Cleese was talking about bad middle management. The Dorchester is the opposite. It's got nothing but top management, right?
Plugged in espresso machines with water.
And Wispens, right?
Yes,
right, and Wispens.
And ready to go. And lots of trash cans in the rooms to
By the way, they have that one. I mean, they have some great food at the Dorchester.
They're
you
terrific.
Never really need to leave the hotel.
No, you don't. You've got China Tang. And you've got the grill, and you've got, it's not Guy Laroche, who's the other guy? The Frenchman.
Jacques Donlebois.
Yeah, exactly, Jacques Donlebois. exactly. Terrific.
We had a drink in their bar, which is stepping back to the 1940s. It's such a cool bar.
Yes, we must mention Roland Fussell, the general manager.
He's a
prince
phenomenal,
among men. Absolutely.
Phenomenal man and a great operation, if you have a chance.
And going to London now is 25% cheaper than it was 6 months ago. And that's a big deal if you're going, because London's a very expensive city. So altogether, it's a jolly good time to go to London.
Yeah, in fact, actually, speaking about the Dorchester, there's the Dorchester collection of hotels.
Yes.
Which includes a great hotel outside of London that's I think, on former polo ground or something like
yes.
that. It's beautiful property. But anyway.
You're on Travel Radio Australia. Next on the show, Jeff Harrison returns with a report he recorded for us in Amsterdam, Holland, in recent times. Here's Jeff.
My guest this week is Stef Kerkhoff from the Netherlands, Amsterdam, in fact. And Stef is the general manager of HollandPass.com, which is a fantastic way to see Amsterdam and various other places as well. Stef, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harrison.
It's a great service you have here. Tell us all about it.
Well, what we actually did is we're now in London. London is quite a big city. Traveling from east to west can take up to 2, maybe even 3 hours. We decided that Amsterdam is nice. It's the main business for tourists when they come over to Holland. We got more to offer, which is quite in the near zone. Talking about Rotterdam, Utrecht, The Hague. So we actually made a city pass which includes these four cities and some important extra attractions like Keukenhof, the Bulbfields in the spring, like the Efteling and the Walibi, and we combine it all together in one booklet which includes all museums and attractions you can visit in Holland. So it's Amsterdam, but also the cities around it, which you can all reach within an hour. And the pass offers you, of course, the museum and attractions. It offers you actually all the information you need, how to travel there. It offers you the priority lane, so you don't always have the long queues. And the whole combination is actually a package for tourists individually coming to the Netherlands who are interested in seeing, well, whatever they want to see. We have more than 100 partners, so they can really choose their favorites. And of course, we work with the Van Gogh Museum, the Rijksmuseum, the Mauritshuis, the big ones. But we also look at the smaller museums, and the combination altogether gives you the time. There's no time pressure to visit it.
Well, that's really impressive, and the good thing is, and not a lot of people know this, because I actually live in Amsterdam, and the thing is that a lot of people don't know the difference between Holland and the Netherlands, because I think Holland is a country. Can you explain that, how that works? Because Holland is actually a province, isn't it?
Well, I think that's the history of it. The thing is, if you travel, people, or actually everyone knows Amsterdam, look at Holland and the Netherlands. Holland is, most people know Holland, but they don't know the Netherlands.
Well, you have North Holland and South Holland, I suppose, and that's like a province or a state of the Netherlands, isn't it? Because there's a lot of other, I think there's 9 or 10 other...
You got 12 provinces.
12, yeah.
And they all have their own capital, of course, so, you got Amsterdam is the head capital, and in North Holland it's Haarlem, which is a beautiful city. I'm living there, by the way. Mm. Then you have South Holland, there's The Hague, also a beautiful city. But of course, it's a small country, but yeah, that's the system, that's how it works, and there are elections for that as well every 4 years.
And Steph, tell us about some of your favorite places to visit. You must have some really standout areas that you can recommend to your customers.
Okay, I have to recommend my whole booklet now, which is a lot, but I will give you some of my recommendations. Personally, I'm from Haarlem, and Haarlem, I would call it a small Amsterdam. It's near to the beach. It has everything to offer that Amsterdam has, but it's a bit smaller and more relaxing. So if you don't like the crowd, go to Haarlem, go to the beautiful St. Bavel Church. Other favorite of me is The Hague. If you look at The Hague, they have some beautiful museums, and especially also the area from The Hague to the beach, Scheveningen. Beautiful parks, it's a lovely city, the government is situated over there. I would recommend a lot of people to go there. And don't forget Rotterdam. I think Rotterdam is maybe after Amsterdam even my most favorite city, because they're different than the rest. They are modern, they offer modern museums, they have hidden bars, hidden treasures. And they're getting more popular and popular every year. So I'm happy to have a lot of content museums also from Rotterdam in the past. Yeah, and of course Utrecht is nice. I have to say something about Utrecht also. Utrecht is a little bit like Amsterdam, also with the canals, and of course beautiful Dam Tower, which is impressive if you go there. Rotterdam also, really nice city, and Haarlem for the smaller Amsterdam. And of course it's Amsterdam, but I don't need to say anything about Amsterdam because everyone knows everything about Amsterdam.
And as far as Holland Pass is concerned, and you're the general manager of hollandpass.com, people can buy this online, they can get it all before they go, right?
Yeah, well, that's the website. The pass itself is Holland Pass. We have a 50% sell with partners. The GWK office is a big partner. Tours and Tickets is a big partner. Of course, our own website is very important. And here at the World Travel Market, we have a lot of meetings with tour operators. Think of Fire Tour, Get Your Guide, Hotel Beds, etc., etc., who sell our product by their own websites. And if you book it online, you have everything before you go, which is always nice. And you see a change in people, of course. Every year, more and more people buy their stuff online and want to have everything before they enter.
And what's the cost of, say, the average Holland Pass? Is it a weekly or a three-day thing, or how does it work?
It's valid for a month, so there's no time pressure. I've got three editions, a small, medium, large. Small is €40, the medium is €55, and the large is €75. It's new prices, we lowered the prices a little bit. And with the pass, take your time, you get a number of tickets, use your tickets when you want. If you're out of tickets, you got unlimited discounts. I cannot show it on the radio, but I can show you. This is an example of the discount card, which you can actually use at all our partners, up to 50% discount. So no time pressure. That's our USP as well. You buy it and you have the time to use it.
Yes, that is excellent, because a lot of people maybe staying for a week or so and they don't want to squeeze everything in on the one day or whatever.
Exactly. That's exactly what we did. We don't want the 24-hour, and then people go to a museum, for example the Van Gogh Museum, which is big, If you stay there for 2 hours, a lot of people are quite tired. They don't want to walk anymore. With our product, you can do the rest later on another day. And with the 24 hour, the 48, you are already limited in time, which I personally don't prefer.
Yes, you don't want to rush those places, because places like the Rijksmuseum, the Van Gogh, you really need a whole day there to see even half of it.
Well, especially after they rebuild it. If you look at the museums now, they're beautiful, but they're so big. It depends. You want to run to a museum and only see the top 10, or you really want to see more of what they have to offer, and they have a lot of things to offer. So I would rather do it a bit easier and come back a day later and pick the other one if you're interested, of course. So, yeah.
And the other advantage of this Holland Pass is that you can skip queues if you have the big one, and you can save a lot of time that way too.
Yeah, skip the line. We call it preferred partner entrance. A lot of people don't like standing in the queue. And for example, also at the attractions at Madame Tussauds, you come in, you show your pass, they open a special cage for you, and you can directly go inside. It saves you time. It's just really nice. We look at the convenient side for the tourist. You get a nice guide. 4 languages, opening times, prices also for children, how to get there with public transportation. The whole package is explained.
Excellent. And how can people find out more, Steph Kirchhoff, from Holland Pass? It's all very easy to find you online.
Yeah, like you already said, the best way is the website, www.hollandpass.com. You see all the information. It's a brand new website since 1 month, so you should check it out if you're interested in going to Holland. Just go to that website.
Great. Steph Kirchhoff, I can say to you, dankjewel, which is thank you very much in Dutch, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Jeff Harrison.
Dankjewel, and tot ziens.
Tot ziens.
Jeff Harrison chatting with Steph Kirchhoff about the Holland Pass. And, of course, Jeff recorded that in Amsterdam, which happens to be the city of my birth many, many, many decades ago. I still have a very soft spot for Amsterdam, and any time I'm on the European mainland, I'll always make a point of calling into the old city and revisiting the sort of scene settings for my long-ago childhood, so to speak. Jeff will be back on the show next month. We have some great upcoming reports from him in future editions. And we have time for one more segment on the show, another one from Travel Writers Radio. This time it's Veronica Matheson in the chair, and she's chatting with Matt Thompson. Matt is the entertainment officer on the Emerald Princess cruise ship, which is doing the rounds here in Australian waters and surrounds.
What is the most popular show on board?
Oh, that's always a big question. I've got to say the production shows across the board are always very popular with the singers and dancers. Our newest show on the Emerald Princess is Magic to Do, which is our collaboration with Stephen Schwartz.
Isn't he a Broadway name?
That's very, very, very famous, actually, in the show scene. He produced Pippin, Wicked and Godspell.
Oh, well, that's a great list of shows.
Yes. His resume is quite exciting, actually, yeah. But Princess Cruises teamed up with him about a year and a half ago, and he agreed to do 4 production shows for Princess Cruises exclusively. Magic to Do was the first one. We've just released Born to Dance on a couple of the ships, but the Emerald Princess is lucky to have Magic to Do.
That sounds terrific. A magic in the show, or is it a musical?
It's a mixture of the two. It's an industry first. There is no one else within any cruise line across the board has ever done something like this. So we've teamed up with a Broadway producer, and he's doing these shows exclusively for Princess Cruises. And the Magic to Do show is about, well, it's got magic, of course, in it, and then linking a love story in there as well. And it's a showcase of Stephen Schwartz's music. You may be familiar with the show Wicked.
Yes.
And Defying Gravity is one of the most famous songs from that show. Well, that song is actually in Magic to Do, and it is fantastic.
Is it likely that this show might come off the sea and go on to land at some stage?
I would like to think no. I'm pretty almost certain, in fact, it is exclusively for Princess, only on the ships.
And you've also got talent competitions on the ship too.
That's right, yes. We have The Voice of the Ocean, which is, it's The Voice, but at sea. So if you're familiar with the TV show of The Voice, so it's The Voice of the Ocean. We have the rotating chairs, of course, which are absolutely fantastic. A great ride when you press the button. I've been lucky enough to do that. But the passengers are the stars. the guests on board. So we have up to 8 contestants that go through, and we have our resident singers that will help be their coaches, and then we do the big final in the Princess Theatre towards the end of the voyage. It is superb. It's like the actual stage of The Voice you see on TV, but live in front of you in the Princess Theatre.
So do you have difficulty getting passengers who are actually prepared to go on this show?
Sometimes they can be a bit shy, but so far since we've launched it, it's been absolutely fantastic. Of course, there's always nerves going on backstage, but we prepare them. We have live bands. Our Princess Orchestra actually play the music, and it's a real buzz for the guests that get involved.
And so there will be a star when you arrive in Sydney, will there? A new star?
Absolutely, yes. There'll be the Voice of the Ocean for that voyage will be crowned the day before.
Yes, tell me about you. Have you actually done any singing?
No, I have the voice of a dirt bike. It's not good when I sing.
So how do you become an entertainment chief?
Well, I started off as a crew staff DJ, which is one of the entertainment staff during the days. You do all the fun events and activities around the ship. And then I used to DJ for the nightclub on board, and then worked my way up to deputy cruise director and cruise director, and now this new position, and that is as entertainment director. So I kind of fell into it, really, from being a professional DJ.
So are you always thinking about what else could we do on board to entertain the guests?
Absolutely. We're always trying to think outside the box, and that's the key thing, is not to get stuck in a rut. There's always the regular popular events that people expect to see on a cruise ship, which is things like Zumba, the workout program, trivia is always popular, and different game shows as well. We have a great team of crew staff on all the ships, and they're very creative people, and they create their own game shows a lot of the time.
Have you ever gone on stage to do the entertaining yourself?
Absolutely. When I was cruise director, it was my prime thing, was to make sure everyone was entertained and go out on stage and tell silly jokes sometimes and have a bit of fun with the guests, and then just chatting to the people around the ship one-on-one and in groups. It's such a great way to meet people.
I guess the thing is, you've got to keep people happy on board, haven't you?
Yes, which is always a challenge with so many different tastes and also nationalities as well. We can have anywhere up to 50 or 60 different nationalities of guests on board at any one time.
And this is the first time that Princess Cruises have brought such a large ship to Australia, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. The Emerald Princess is the newest and biggest ship that we've sent down here. So it's great to be part of bringing this ship down here, and it is a beautiful vessel.
It's a large ship. Is there enough passengers to come on board?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Australia seems to love cruising, so I think that's why Princess chose this ship to send down.
Because
the sheer size.
And all the berths are full, are they?
Yes, all the cabins are full right now, so you won't be able to join us just yet. But
and where are you going to go to now in Australia? Your home port is going to be Sydney.
That's right, yep. And then so we're going to be leaving Australia, going over to New Zealand and cruising around New Zealand, both North and South Islands, one of my favourite parts of the world as well, and also out to the South Pacific Islands as well, which is, again, just stunning as well.
So everybody's in search of the sun.
That's it. We're chasing the sun. Hopefully New Zealand will give us some decent weather. Well, you know what Melbourne's like? 4 seasons in the day, isn't it? I think that's what they say.
Oh, that's a reputation. Now, your accent, you're obviously from what? England?
I'm from, the south coast, a tiny little island called Portsmouth. Very much known for its naval heritage. It's a maritime city, but only an island of about 14 miles across, but about 300,000 people live there. It's so very densely populated.
I didn't realise, actually, my ignorance, that actually Portsmouth was an island.
That's right. It used to be called Portsea Island many, many years ago, way before you or I were around, I believe.
Right.
But it is an island. There's only 2 bridges on and off, so it's a very small place. But it's huge for live bands and entertainment, actually. We've got a lot of festivals that are becoming bigger and bigger on Portsmouth Island itself. So
is that where you started your disc jockeying?
It was where I started DJing.
So, as you say, from there you went into the entertainment business and you've never looked back.
That's right, yeah. I've spent a lot of time cruising in and out of Australia on the Sea Princess, the Dawn Princess, the Sapphire Princess and the Diamond, and now, of course, the Emerald.
There's a lot of princess ships around, aren't there?
We're taking over.
That's a grab from Travel Writers Radio Melbourne, Veronica Matheson, chatting with Matt Thompson from the Emerald Princess cruise ship. And that's all we have for you on this month's edition of Travel Radio Australia. We'll be back next month with a brand new show, and we'd like to thank all our guests and presenters before we go. Firstly, of course, Jeff Harrison, then of course the Travel Writers Radio crew, Graeme Kemlow and Veronica Matheson. Then we had our sister show in the US, Around the World Radio and TV, which you can get on their website, atw.tv. That's an easy one to remember. Thank you, Arthur and Richard and all the other crew over there in America. And that's all we have for sure. We'll be back next month. Until then, I'm Renz Weirs, wishing you all happy trails.